It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll find out why animals like to play with firsthand stories from a scientist who's been observing elephants for years. First, the Wisconsin DNR is proposing a quota of 130 wolves in a state hunt to begin in November of this year. The DNR is calling that number conservative after a court-ordered hunt took place in February of this year that resulted in more than 200 wolves being killed in just a matter of days over the initial capacity. The Wisconsin Natural Resources Board will consider the proposal in its August meeting. We want to talk about this news and take a look outside of Wisconsin and find out how some of our Great Lakes neighbors have been looking at this issue. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of a second wolf hunt in Wisconsin in 2021? Is your life impacted by wolves, good, bad, or other? Did you participate in the February hunt? Are you involved in wolf advocacy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Peter David is a biologist with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. Peter, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be here, Rob. I hope you're well.
And you as well. Now, there's a long backstory. Can you sum up right now for us where we are when it comes to the delisting of the gray wolf here in the Midwest from the endangered species list?
Well, the delisting became effective in early January. And, of course, Wisconsin had the lawsuit that pushed them into a hunt, I guess, that we're really not prepared for. And so we also saw what happened in February with a quota being exceeded by about 83%. Mm-hmm. And that season was also really unique because it was nestled completely within the wolves' breeding season. So Wisconsin, in some ways, has already had almost the equivalent of two hunts in that February hunt, and now we're preparing for the fall.
Can you compare and contrast for us a little bit Wisconsin with our neighbors in Michigan and Minnesota? Very different laws, for one thing, and outcomes. How do we compare to our neighbors?
Well, the fact that Wisconsin's getting ready for this hunt is probably the biggest, most obvious difference. And Wisconsin is the only state here of the three that has this law that requires a hunting season to take place anytime wolves are not on the endangered species list. The other two states really give more credence to their Departments of Natural Resources to determine the path that's most appropriate to go forward. And so both of those states, I think, are going to be considering hunts, no doubt, in the future, but clearly are in no rush to do it right now. Neither one will have a season this fall. Even though in Michigan the population of wolves is fairly similar to the level that we have here in Wisconsin, and in Minnesota it's about 2.5 times as high. And yet there's no great push to take on a hunting season at this time.
What kind of things do you think, what kind of research do you think should go into wolf numbers before a state declares a hunting season in those states that have that that option, as you say, in Michigan and Minnesota?
Well, obviously the first thing you need is a good pre-hunt population. And Wisconsin has a new occupancy model that they're using to estimate the wolf population. It hasn't been fully screened, I think, yet, but it seems to be a pretty darn good model. But one of the real problems actually right now is that the most recent population estimate came before the February season. And so we had that harvest, and then we're going to actually have the one at fall before we have any new population data. And that introduces a lot of uncertainty because we really don't know the full impacts of that February hunt yet. And we really never will because it's going to end up being sort of blended with what happens in the fall now.
I've heard from different conservation biologists with different reads on what the right number of gray wolves in Wisconsin should be. There's a smaller number that people point to based on kind of the current habitat available for wolves that won't lead to too many conflicts with humans, a higher number for people who look at the old range of wolves, the original or the older numbers that might be here. Where do you fall in that debate?
Well, I think, you know, wolves are species which are very good at limiting their own numbers. And we've seen, actually, their population has stopped growing in both Minnesota and in Michigan. And there's no doubt that the population is very close to stopping growing here in Wisconsin based on the amount of habitat that we have relative to the other states. So while 1,000 animals, ball ballpark. Sounds like a lot to some people. You know, in the context of other species, it's really a very modest number. We have, you know, approximately 24,000 or 25,000 bears in the state, for example. And people don't seem to be overly concerned about those kinds of figures. And so we have not yet seen a sound argument that says there's a particular need to reduce the wolf population.
We're talking to Peter David, biologist with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, about gray wolves in Wisconsin and the hunting of those wolves. Wisconsin already had a hunt this year, another one likely in November. You can join us with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Peter, from what you just said there, wolves can control their own numbers. Do you ever see a situation in which a gray wolf hunt makes a good sense from a conservation perspective?
You know, I haven't really seen that. We've looked very closely at all of the arguments that are commonly given for a hunting season, and they really don't hold up to scientific scrutiny. So issues like that they're greatly reducing the deer herd don't hold up when they're looked at carefully and scientifically. Livestock depredations, while that is an issue, certainly if you're an individual who has depredations, the total level of depredations is very small, and we know that a hunt is actually a very ineffective way of dealing with that problem. You can imagine if you lose a calf in the springtime, having a hunt in the fall, which may not even affect wolves in your area, is really not a very effective strategy or much help to a person in that situation. So, and we know, again, the wolf population doesn't need to be tamped down because it does that itself. So there really hasn't been a strong argument put forward. And even the argument that wolves are sort of a renewable resource that could be harvested and have some value doesn't really hold up when you look at the numerics involved. For example, in Wisconsin, the collective amount paid by hunters and trappers to apply for and to purchase a wolf license comes to about $1,500 for every wolf that was harvested in February, and that's probably about 10 times what the value of that pelt might be. And then I would add to that our member tribes are just opposed to the recreational harvest of a species whom they have great cultural connection to, understand to be a brother spirit, and performs ecological values that the tribes really depend upon.
We're talking to biologist Peter David about the science of a wolf hunt and gray wolf management practices in states around the Great Lakes. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support the idea of a wolf hunt here in Wisconsin? If you do you support the idea of a second one in 2021? Do you have questions about gray wolves, how they fit into habitats here in the state? Are you a listener in Minnesota or Michigan where this hunt is not happening, at least not yet? What do you think? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Peter David, biologist with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. We're looking at the new wolf hunt quota proposed for November this year by the Wisconsin DNR and how Minnesota and Michigan look at wolves a little differently than Wisconsin does. Wisconsin has a law requiring a wolf hunt if the gray wolves are off of the endangered species list, which they currently are. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Peter, you mentioned that wolves have mechanisms to kind of cap their population themselves. What do we know about that?
Well, part of it is probably prey abundance related. And although they eat deer, which are very abundant in Wisconsin, you know, they really focus on animals that are sick or injured or ill. And so that's a much smaller component of the overall population. The other thing is that wolves are highly territorial animals. And so in places like Yellowstone, where there's very little human-caused mortality, wolves themselves can be the factor that really limits the population and keeps it from growing high.
And I mentioned, and we've talked about wolves currently off the endangered species list in the Midwest, but I understand there's a lawsuit coming from Michigan looking to change that. Is it possible that this will go back in the other direction again?
Well, I think that is possible. Certainly, there have been seesaws back and forth on this over time. And there are a lot of people and a lot of scientists who had real concern about this current delisting. And it's a tough issue to tackle because I think people here in Wisconsin, for example, look at it very locally. But the delisting rule really looked at the recovery of wolves here in the Great Lakes region. And based on that recovery, delisted wolves from literally Maine to California. And that's a big part of what this lawsuit is based on. Michigan, for example, saying that, you know, you can't use recovery in our state to delist wolves in other places where they have yet to recover at all.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Elizabeth is with us in La Crosse. Elizabeth, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. And really, thank you for just bringing this issue to light for the public. It was really devastating for me to hear this last year that the wolf hunt was just so barbaric and that the numbers of the bloodletting were so massive in that first day that it had to be shut down. I recall being in high school and wolf conservation being a really big deal back then. We had guest speakers who would come and talk about the importance of the wolf population. And I guess the question that I have is it true that it was out-of-state hunters who were pushing for the culling in Wisconsin just to have a hunt in Wisconsin, and it really didn't even come from the citizens and the residents of Wisconsin for this initial wolf hunt?
Elizabeth, thanks for the call. Peter, you're a biologist, but you know where the impetus for this hunt came from.
Well, the legal challenge was brought by this group called Hunter Nation, which is, in fact, not, I think, headquartered in Iowa, if I believe right. They are headquartered out of state. And it is an interesting issue because we know that the public, actually, in all three states, are actually very supportive of wolf populations. If you look at, for example, just this year, Minnesota did a public attitude survey towards wolves and found some really pretty remarkable numbers, that 86% of the people in the state favored having the same or more wolves going into the future. And the wolf range, again, was seen by 89% of the people that there's no need to make any reduction in that. The last social survey in Wisconsin, of those people who had an opinion, about 70% statewide, or 73%, supported having as many or more wolves. That survey was done back in 2015 when about 800 wolves were in the state. And there's similar work in Michigan where through public referendums there's been strong support shown for wolves. So it's an interesting dichotomy where the general public tends to have very favorable attitudes, but they aren't being listened to very much by groups like the Natural Resources Board, who tend to be much more responsive to sort of the traditional hook and bullet clubs that they tend to represent.
Thanks for the call. We're going to Mary now in Spooner. Mary, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Mary?
Well, I'm a forest tech, so I'm in the woods a lot in northern Wisconsin. I live in Spooner. And I'm not seeing, like, an exorbitant amount of number of wolves. I never have. In fact, I've never seen one. I've only seen signs and tracks and scat and whatnot. However, my biggest question is, we have already fulfilled that horrible law that they must be hunted for the year. Therefore, why do we have to have another season when we don't even know what we're going into?
Mary, thanks a lot for that call. Peter, the rush to the February one, I think, was to get one in the 2020-2021 season, and then this November one would be for 21-22, but please correct me if I have that wrong.
No, I think you have that exactly right. I will say there is concern that even if there was no fall hunt, the wolf population actually probably would not rebound back to the level it was before the February hunt. So from a biological perspective, there are concerns, but your interpretation of that law and why they are going ahead with it is exactly right.
Mary, thanks a lot for that call. We'll go to Tomas now in Madison. Tomas, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had a question, maybe a request for comment, about how the development of science seems to more and more support the cultural understanding of ecological delicacy and nuance that kind of similar to the native understanding, as opposed to the kind of bull in the china shop approach that we're more used to. I was just wondering if you might be able to comment on that.
Tomas, thanks for the call. Do you have thoughts on that, Peter?
Well, that's an interesting one. And there's probably some tribal elders who'd be much more qualified to answer that. But, you know, I think we are seeing a lot of the wisdom in some of the tribal perspectives. And people sometimes sort of discount the tribal perspective as being purely cultural, their desire to protect wolves, for example. And I would argue that the desire, actually the great animosity that we sometimes see towards wolves from other cultures, is really just a cultural artifact itself. And it's also really worth remembering that the tribes here in the Midwest also coexisted with wolves on the landscape for a very long period of time. And so it's certainly an example that coexistence is possible, and that appreciation for the role that wolves play ecologically is something we need to embrace.
Thanks a lot for that call. Peter, in our just last minute or so, what are you watching for now, between now and November, to see if this hunt is going to happen, if the numbers are going to change, if research is going to change anything? What are you looking for?
You know what I'd most like to see, I guess, would be that both the general public in the state and the tribal voice are really listened to and given the credence they deserve. We have a real issue, I think, in the Natural Resources Board right now, and we obviously have an individual not stepping down and who's preventing a super qualified woman from having the same opportunity that he had to serve the state of Wisconsin. And I hope that we can rectify that situation soon.
Peter, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure. Take care and stay well.
That's Peter David, biologist with the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. We talked to him today about the recent DNR proposal of a quota for a November wolf hunt this year. That would be the second one in the state in 2021. And for a look at how neighboring Great Lakes states have managed their populations. Communities around Wisconsin continue to find PFAS, often called forever chemicals, in their drinking water supplies. But once the contamination is discovered, finding a fix or an alternative water source is not an easy task for residents. Hope Kerwin has more from French Island, one of the latest communities here in Wisconsin to discover PFAS in their water.
French Island sits between the Mississippi and Black Rivers. It's home to part of the city of La Crosse and the town of Campbell. And it's where Dale and Mary Wetterling decided to build their home 30 years ago.
It was my husband's dream house. So it'll be a sad day when we have to move out of this house.
But the two retired school teachers have a new housemate, Aqua Maria. That's the name Mary gave their Culligan water dispenser when it arrived last fall after the couple found out their private well was contaminated with PFAS.
It had to have a name, right? I mean, like, you bring a child into the world, you give them a name. Some people name their boats.
PFAS, often called forever chemicals, are a group of man-made substances that don't break down and have been linked to adverse health effects like increased cholesterol, cancer, and thyroid disease. In 2019, the State Department of Natural Resources ordered the city of La Crosse to investigate PFAS in city-owned wells on French Island that officials believe came from firefighting foam used at and around the La Crosse Regional Airport. The city, state, and residents eventually tested more than 500 of the island's private wells. Only 12 did not have some level of PFAS. More than a quarter exceeded the state's recommended standard for drinking water. The DNR declared an emergency water advisory for the island in March. Now the city and state are providing residents those 5-gallon water jugs. But Mary Wetterling says the jugs are an imperfect solution for her and her older neighbors.
We have two women on our street who are widows, and they literally cannot pick up that big, huge gallon.
Finding a permanent source of clean water for Campbell residents is already proving elusive. Campbell Town Chair Josh Johnson says the municipality doesn't have the money to build its own water system. Treating the island's nearly 1,500 private wells would be costly, and digging them deeper could spread the contamination. But Johnson says many residents prefer the independence and lower property taxes that come with their private wells.
They don't want anything from anybody else, and they want to do it their own way. A lot of them want to keep their own wells and put in their own treatment systems. A lot of them already have.
The DNR has recommended that communities like Campbell tap into municipal water systems like the City of La Crosse when available. But town residents are skeptical, and city officials aren't rushing to offer water anyway. In an interview with WPR's Newsmakers, Mayor Mitch Reynolds said evaluating the best path forward will take time.
We can't jump into solutions that may be ineffective, and we're not at the point where we are providing remediation or mitigation.
More than 900 Campbell residents are planning to take legal action against La Crosse over the contamination and for failing to notify them when the chemicals were first discovered in city water in 2014. La Crosse filed its own lawsuit in March, claiming the chemical companies that make PFAS knew about the chemicals' risks for decades and continued to use them. But winning one of these legal battles doesn't guarantee an easy path to a solution. Earlier this year, residents in the town of Peshtigo in northern Wisconsin reached a $17.5 million settlement with a chemical company over PFAS. But residents are still waiting for a permanent source of safe water. That scares Campbelltown Supervisor Lee Donahue.
3.5 years from now, we do not want to be drinking bottled water. We want to be drinking a safe alternative water source.
It's the same fear that pushed Dale and Mary Wetterling to pay $3,000 to have a water filtration system put into their home earlier this year.
You had to do something because we don't know how long we're going to be here, and I'm sure we're going to move out of here before that's resolved.
Dale worries about his neighbors who can't afford that kind of expense. He says they're all anxious about how the contamination will impact their property values and how their health may have already been affected. It may be years before they have answers to those questions and more. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Tomorrow, we'll hear about the town of Peshtigo, where residents have been relying on bottled water for years. You can read more about these communities at WPR.org. Coming up after the news, who likes to play? A world-renowned elephant expert helps us understand why non-human animals, including elephants, like to play. There's a lot of reasons behind it. It looks like fun, but they may be learning a lot along the way. You can hear all these great conversations whenever you want. Stream online at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. You can listen live or check out the extensive archives of past conversations. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, it's a new installment of Ask a Contractor with a focus on plumbing. Call in with your plumbing questions and maybe the lessons you've learned the hard way. It's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now we think of playing as something you do for fun. It's in the name. And we might think play is mostly a human thing. But many animals, not just humans, have evolved to play. Lion cubs wrestle, young elephants spar and chase, wolf pups tackle each other, and they do it for a reason. In her latest book, our next guest digs into play and a number of other behaviors in the animal world. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What animals have you observed playing, whether it's your pets or the wildlife in your own backyard? What have you seen them do? Why do you think they do it? Have you noticed similarities between how we humans play and how other animals play? Call it at 800-642-1234 with your observations or your questions. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Caitlin O'Connell is a world-renowned elephant expert and author, most recently of Wild Rituals, 10 Lessons Animals Can Teach Us About Connection, Community, and Ourselves. She's on the faculty at Harvard Medical School and is an associate of Harvard Center for the Environment and the Center for Conservation Biology at Stanford University. Caitlin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me.
We humans might think we have a monopoly on playful behavior. How common is what we would call play amongst our animal cousins?
Sorry, I didn't hear the last part.
How do we compare play?
How common is play among animals?
Oh, how common. Oh, well, play is actually an essential survival tool. You know, we think of it as a fun activity, and watching our dogs play, it looks like they're, you know, really enjoying themselves. But evolutionarily, play is critical to animals learning how to avoid predators or learning how to catch prey, and what's called locomotive play. When animals run and chase each other, they're actually developing motor skills, and that's so true for kids playing as well, developing motor skills, but also for children, it's developing language skills and negotiation skills, trusting and team building. And that goes on the same way with elephant play, with wolf play, with lions playing, building trust, to learning how to form a group to cooperate in say a hunt. When early man was hunting large game, they couldn't do it by themselves. They had to do it with a group of people. And play is a way of developing strength within the group, coordinating behavior. And so there's many different reasons why animals play, and it's not just for fun.
You've observed elephants a lot. Can you tell us some of what kind of things elephants do to play, especially young elephants?
Well, elephants, just like the play bow in dogs, where the one dog will bow down to the other to announce that they are entering the safe zone of play, elephants will place their trunk over the head of another to announce their intent that they would like to spar and play with each other. And the play mostly for young male elephants involves sparring with each other. Just very similar to jousting or martial art, to fencing, really, where the elephants would push back and forth with their trunks and face each other. And it looks very much like martial art. What they're doing is testing each other's strength and developing their skills for real combat later in life, when they have to confront an opponent who would come at them with their tusks. And if they turn sideways in any way, their tusk could go right into the rib. So this is a basically mortal combat that they have to avoid and learn the skills in which to navigate such a challenge. And so sparring from a very early age is a lot of fun, but it's also teaching young male elephants how to survive later in when they're trying to challenge another bull in order to mate with a female.
That makes me think, I was wondering if it's a human-centric question to ask, but are they having fun? Can we tell that they're having fun doing this kind of play in the same way that we might?
Well, you know, it definitely looks that way. And all of our hallmarks of fun, and let's use primates as an example, because great apes have a play face. A chimpanzee, when they approach another, they actually show their top and bottom teeth as a way of announcing that they want to play. And they have very similar facial expressions to humans, including the smile. And so that psychologically is a parallel. It's kind of like looking in the mirror, and it's an activity that is a positive activity. And they sure look like they're having fun.
We're talking to Caitlin O'Connell, author of the book Wild Rituals, 10 Lessons Animals Can Teach Us About Connection, Community, and Ourselves. We're talking about one portion of that book, play. Lots of animals like to play. They get a lot of benefit out of it. You could join in with your thoughts, your observations of your pets or other animals, or your questions about animals and play. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Caitlin, you gave that example of elephants doing their martial arts play. That's a kind of a locomotive play where they're learning how to do physical stuff. Social play is another category you've mentioned. What kind of social play do we see amongst animals?
Yeah, well, lion cubs are a great example where litter mates will jump on top of each other and run after each other and trip each other and then pile on top of each other, which elephants love to pile on top of each other too. And for lions, this is, if you watch their exact behavior, they're actually trying to trip their litter mate and then grab onto their neck with their mouth, biting either the spinal cord or the throat. And that's exactly what they would do when they're trying to take down prey. So this is a wonderful way to practice. And, you know, when a lion gets to about 2 or so years old, they try and practice this hunting behavior on ungulates, you know, like a zebra, for example. And sometimes they're not very good at it at all. But when they have the opportunity to practice with a trusted litter mate, they can really explore and experiment and test their strength a lot better than if they didn't have that social opportunity to play.
Another kind of play you write about is object play, where animals play with, for want of a better word, a toy of some sort, a stick or a rock or whatever. Can you give us some examples of that kind of object play among animals?
Yes. Well, elephants love to have a stick in hand and run around with it and have another one chase them. Lions will do that. Sometimes they'll do it with a live animal, like a mongoose, which is horrible to watch, but they will bat it around in play so that they learn how to deal with what would happen next if you bat the poor little live mongoose in one direction. How would they chase it in another direction? And then they might do that with a dead animal, or like I talk about in my book, they love a black fuzzy windsock from a microphone. They love to bat that around the waterhole, which is which is not good for us, but it's very amusing to watch because they, for whatever reason, kitty cats of all kinds are drawn to this strange black fuzzy object because it must look like a great attractive prey item, and they will play with that until you try and take it away, which can be very challenging.
A hazard for researchers and reporters, I bet. Let's bring out a caller now.
Yes.
Taryn is with us in Toma. Taryn, hello.
Hi. I just wanted to share this really cute story. While I was walking down a green circle, I saw this red-capped woodpecker mother, and she was, like, showing her children around. So her children were, like, jumping and playing on the trees right beside her. But she was trying to show them, like, how to peck in the bark with her beak to get bugs and stuff. Well, one of the kids didn't really understand how to use his beak. So he just looked at the tree, looked at his mom. He's like, oh, like this, Mom? He goes, doosh, with his head to the tree. Just bangs his head on the tree a couple times. And it was just hilarious to see.
Taryn,
oh,
thanks.
That's a great observation.
Definitely. Well, that kind of play as mimicry to learn a key life skill, Caitlin, that fits into some of the examples we've talked about, I think.
Yes. And even to go beyond the mimicry, there's also examples of ravens and other birds that will take mimicry to the next level of caching, pretending to cache items, and then observing other ravens around them to see who they might trust not to unbury their precious item. And those would be the ravens that they would then associate with because they could trust them. So, you know, birds are really, really intelligent. And that's wonderful that you got to see that the mom teaching example. There's lots of wonderful mother teaching examples or getting involved in play, like a lioness in particular, or another example I talk about in my book is horses, that a mother horse would spend a lot of time teaching her offspring how to play. And there's great studies to show that the mothers that spend more time with their colts playing, their colts do better later. They're better physically, and they do better reproductively because of the amount of time that moms play with them in their youth. So mothers play a very important role in teaching, but also playing as a form of teaching.
Taryn, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Caitlin O'Connell, world-renowned elephant expert and author most recently of Wild Rituals, 10 Lessons Animals Can Teach Us About Connection, Community, and Ourselves. She's talking to us today about why animals like to play. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about animals, why they play and exhibit those kind of behaviors? Do you have observations to share of animals in your house, in your yard, or beyond at play? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. If you've got pictures or videos, we'd love to see them. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with elephant researcher Caitlin O'Connell. She's telling us about why animals, including elephants, like to play. It's one of the animal rituals she explores in her new book, Wild Rituals. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Tell us about a sighting of animals at play that you could share, or join in with a question at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Barb is with us in Madison. Barb, hi.
Hi. I just love this topic, and I could spend hours watching the TV show on the Bronx Zoo, because I grew up in New York, just out in New York City until I was about 5 years old. And my mom used to take us to the Bronx Zoo all the time. And they've made such progress in the way that they now husband their animals and train them. But I have an interspecies play observation from my own backyard on the north side of Madison. I think it was the beginning of last week. I happened to be looking out at my neighbor's yard, and there were two squirrels, there were younger squirrels, that were running around and rattling and rolling and running up and down the trunk of a tree, and a bunny rabbit came out from underneath the bush at the back of the yard, and they started running around with the rabbit, and the rabbit seemed to be bouncing around playing with them, too. It was a smaller, younger rabbit with these smaller, younger squirrels, gray squirrels. It was a funnest thing to watch.
That sounds like a lot of fun, Barb. Caitlin, play, interspecies play, Barb called it there.
That's wonderful. Well, I also grew up going to the Bronx Zoo as well, growing up in New Jersey. And yes, they have done wonderful things to improve habitats for a lot of the species, particularly great apes and elephants. But interspecies play is a fascinating area. And, you know, I can think of the honey guide bird and the honey badger as examples of why it would be beneficial for two species to play, because they could also then later in life show each other where resources. So a honey guide bird has a specific call to attract a honey badger when it finds a hive, and it leads the honey badger to the hive. And this also works for humans as well. They've been known to do this. And then the honey badger opens up the hive, and then the bird gets to share the hive with the honey badger, which it wouldn't normally be able to do without that. So there are a lot of benefits and examples of interspecies cooperation that could start by this kind of informal play. And I've never seen squirrels and rabbits playing together. That's wonderful.
Barb, thanks.
That's a great example.
Thanks for sharing that backyard observation. We'll go to Kelsey now in Milwaukee. Kelsey, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to ask about, Kelsey?
Yes, I was calling in because there's kind of this whole notion is near and dear to my heart. I'm a health coach and a nutritionist, and there's a lot of research out there, you know, pertaining to play and those types of rituals that us animal adjacent human mammals can put into practice. And so being familiar with the work in Wild Rituals and looking at the research otherwise in humans, this is something that I encourage my clients to do, as far as relieving stress and things like that, before we even ever talk about nutrition, ever talk about exercise, because there's just so many benefits to it. And I think that there, you know, like we were speaking to, a lot of things that we can learn from the play that animals have in our own lives and trying new things, going after new activities, new hobbies, and exercising our own minds in relation to other people in that way as well.
Kelsey, thank you so much for that call. Caitlin, that's right up your alley. What can we learn?
Yeah, I'm so glad you're contributing that perspective, because I've been learning partly from writing the play chapter, but also my sister-in-law is in this similar field where adult play is just something that you don't think about. You think that play is for kids, or as adults you might play board games together, but playing, just an organic playing, going outside and running around and seeing what kind of imaginary game comes to mind, is a very, very powerful tool. And corporate organizations actually realize this, and which is really good. They're investing energy in having teams play together and having that challenge. What it does in a very isolated situation, if you think of people in a boardroom trying to pitch an idea, if they had come from a play exercise, they would be in a safe zone where they could experiment with ideas, explore innovative thinking that they wouldn't normally do in an environment where they're not that confident or they don't trust that the others would respect their idea. And play has turned out to be a very important tool to help drive innovation in a business setting. And that's just one other example. But I'm really glad that you're supporting this idea in your practice, because I think it's a really important fundamental tool to drive innovation, but also drive relaxation and even building trust within the family, extended family, and in the community at large.
Kelsey, thanks so much for the call. Time for one more caller. Lynn is with us in Hustisford. Lynn, hi.
Hi. A couple of years ago, I was walking about a mile from my house, and there was a fence post that was kind of on a slant, and there were a couple of little weasels who would slide down the fence post, run around to the top, and slide down again, and repeatedly do that, taking turns sliding down the fence post, until Mom poked her head up and chittered at them. And it was sort of, hey, it's time to come home, kids. And they trotted off after her and disappeared.
I love it,
Lynn. Oh, it was adorable.
Wonderful.
I love it. Thank you so much for sharing that. People had a lot of great sightings, Caitlin. Can you leave us in just our last minute with one more lesson we can learn from our great observations, like weasels on a fence post?
Yeah, that's wonderful. I mean, that's a great example of how prey learn how to evade predators. You know, I mentioned that in my Scientific American article this month on play, where I've seen sea lions surfing down waves just like people on a surfboard and really looking like they're enjoying themselves, a whole bunch of them, and kind of shooting through the wave and leaping out the other side, which is a perfect mechanism to put yourself as far as possible from a great white shark as you can. And so those weasels learning how to move in a very creative, innovative way. And what will happen when I slide down this pole? Oh, I shouldn't be afraid, because at the end, I can just bolt off in this direction. And it just gives them confidence and agility in order to avoid predators. And that's a wonderful sighting that you have of these weasels. I wish I was there.
Thanks for that call, Lynn. And Caitlin, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me. It was great.
That's Caitlin O'Connell, elephant expert and author of the book Wild Rituals, 10 Lessons Animals Can Teach Us About Connection, Community, and Ourselves. She joined us for a look at why, how, and when animals like to play. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, annual holidays aren't the only time we like to celebrate. We'll find out how personal milestones affect our lives, and you can tell us how you've celebrated them this year. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Speaking of playful animals, an image from the Netherlands has been getting a lot of attention online. It's a picture of a goose, a species called the bean goose. Only this particular bean goose is flying upside down. Is it a trick photo or just a lucky moment in the midst of a goose barrel roll? No, it turns out it's the real deal. As reported by the Zenger News Service, ornithologists say this is actually a common maneuver for a number of bird species. And it's common enough that it has a name. And that's the best part, as far as I'm concerned. It's called whiffling, like wiffle ball, wiffle bat. When I say the goose is flying upside down, it's even a little stranger than that. When birds whiffle, they turn their entire bodies upside down, but then rotate their heads 180 degrees. So bodies upside down, but their face is right side up. Why, if you're a bird, would you whiffle? Can be a trick, apparently, to throw off flying predators or maybe ones on the ground waiting for you to land. It confuses them, I guess, a different image. But it may also be a way to show off to other birds of the same species, like the bird equivalent of look ma, no hands on a bike. Whiffle while you work. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.